Guys, my album Karate is out now. I'm so excited. You can get it on iTunes and you can stream it on Spotify. If you don't know how to look up either of those things, you can go on charlottelarston.com. So come through, yo. It's out. Karate.
Karate. I wasn't always Black Girl Magic all the time. And I'm not going to lie to another Black girl and act like I was. I was severely traumatized. Yeah. At the moment where I stood my ground, I hate to say it, but I was like, a Black man used that against me. Before I go to bed, you know, after I pray or like whatever, I'll just be like, you know, you are loved, you are full of love, and you're gonna be okay, kiddo. And then I'll just like go to sleep.
This is The Secret Lives of Black Women. I'm Lauren.
I'm Sharla.
And today it's a very special episode. We had a launch day event at the Greenlight Bookstore, and we talked to Morgan Jerkins, and it was a delight. There was lots of wine
free
and celebration, and, you know, we talked about everything from, like, dating stories, emotional labor, being a Black writer. Morgan talks about how she unwinds, and it's just, you know, the audio is a little wonky because it is a live event, but it's also hilarious and special, and I think that you can hear the joy in our voices of just having the dream of this podcast being manifest into reality, and the first time that we're sharing it with people, ourselves, and an audience, and it was a good time, and we want you guys to be a part of that good time, so we're sharing it with you. There's some really good moments that it's worth the listen despite audio glitches, because it was a live event. It was our first live event.
Yeah.
First of many, hopefully. And we hope you enjoy our talk with Morgan.
Take a listen.
Thank you.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming to our launch event. We're so excited to talk to Morgan, and we're so excited to, like, have a podcast.
to just be here with you guys. So we normally do this in a room, and it's just the two of us, like, staring deeply in each other's
into each
eyes,
other's
like,
full-on,
like, best friendship mode. So I'm really nervous to see. And, I mean, there's so many cute people here tonight, many beautiful Black women. So why did we decide to do this podcast, Sharla?
Real talk. Yeah. So I had been wanting to do a podcast for a really long time. I actually, it's particularly after this last election, because it was so traumatic. And I just wanted a space to, like, scream that. And I actually, I linked up with one of my white comedy friends to do it. And I love her very much, but it just didn't feel right. It didn't feel right because it felt like I wasn't able to. I felt like I was apologizing the whole time for being very angry about something. And I wanted to not do that. I wanted to have a space where I could just talk to other Black women. So I asked Lauren if she wanted to do a podcast with me. And we came up with The Secret Lives of Black Women. And we were just like, let's just do something where we have a space where we don't have to feel like we have to apologize for anything.
Well, apologize or explain ourselves. Like, I feel like there's this constant thing of people being like, but why do you feel that way? And you're like, what do you mean, why? Like, I walk out my house, that's why. I breathe.
This is going to be a very controversial statement, but I remember, like, the catalyst was, like, after Trump got elected, I was doing a stand-up set, and I was super angry, and I was just expressing my feelings. And afterwards, the comic that got up was a white guy, and he asked me, do you hate white people? And I was like, all right, I'm done. I don't want to explain this. Yeah.
So all that led us to being here, and, you know, all that. But more so in that, you know, we both found this really great shared experience of when you exist in the world and that moment of connection and feeling seen and understood is huge to me, and understanding myself and moving through the world. So being able to do that with friends like Sharla and the different guests that we've had has been a really transformative process to get, like, super personal and deep, you know, between me, my God, therapist, and now you. but, you know, a lot of you are here also to listen to our guest. And we're really
we're so excited.
Beyond excited to have Morgan Jerkins with us here tonight.
Yeah.
I'm at a loss for words, which feels really inappropriate in this bookstore speaking about Morgan, but she's that phenomenal. She is the writer of This Will Be My Undoing. It debuted on the New York Times bestseller list and is longlisted for the Penn Diamandstein Spiegelville Award for Art and Essay. She's a former associate editor at Catapult, and she currently teaches at Columbia MFA in nonfiction. We're going to chop
introduce
it up at Morgan.
Yeah. Morgan Jerkins.
Oh my god.
Okay. Morgan, I loved reading your book so much because it felt like I felt like a lot of it was in my own brain already. It's really weird. What made you decide to write such a personal book and put it out there?
I didn't want to do nonfiction at first. My first love is fiction. I got into fiction because I was bullied a lot in high school, and I don't know if I can fight, so I internalized a lot of what I wanted to do, and I found solace in creating these new worlds. So I would come home and hurry up and do my homework and then just write. And so I was writing fiction. I was querying all of these agents and nothing was happening. And probably like after I graduated college, I didn't get a job in publishing like I thought I would. I had to move back home. And at 2014, which is 5 years ago, which might have been like it's now like the Jurassic Age in terms of digital media because of how much it's shifting. That's when the Black Lives Matter movement happened. And then all of these editors were looking around their newsrooms and like, oh, we need some Black people to write. But they're not here, so we have to go outward.
Yes.
And so I was seeing all these people around my age that were producing content. And I was like, oh, like they're producing content and you get paid to write? Okay, so then I'm going to start doing it too. And my agent actually found me through Twitter. And we were shuffling around ideas. And she was like, well, why don't you write nonfiction first? Because you're establishing an audience that knows that voice already. And I was like, well, I don't really know what to write about. And at the time, I was like, nonfiction seems so stiff. Like, I was like, I thought nonfiction was for those who were experts in a field, who have been, you know, researching scholarship for like 30 years, or someone who has had like an extraordinary life.
Well, you were living as a Black woman.
I'm talking about like Malala level. Not like South Jersey Black girl.
Also, you know what I'm saying? Experience.
You know what I mean? Like, that's like, okay, if you want to read a book, because that's extraordinary, right? But yeah, so, and it was interesting because if any of you aren't familiar with the book publishing industry, in order to sort of submit, go on submission, which means that your agent sends something to an editor and they want to consider acquiring it, you have to write something called a book proposal. So as soon as I endeavored to write a book about Black girlhood, Black womanhood through personal essays and cultural commentary, all of a sudden it just felt like I was resurrecting these memories. Like all these memories that I never gave myself the space to sit with at the time that it happened. And these were memories like 10 plus years ago that finally I felt like I had the words and the money, I'm not gonna lie, to be able to sit there with these feelings and give myself the grace to sort through them as ugly as they were.
Well, that's like a thing that really struck me in your book is feeling like you've been seen, right? And a lot of that comes from the person that's conveying the emotion being totally open, which is something that we've had to, you know, force ourselves to do with the podcast in terms of telling stories, even if some names are redacted, being like, I'm going to be an open book. And you are down to like what gives you off in masturbation, like people that you've dated, your people that you hate, negative thoughts that you've had that we've all had that I don't know if I would share publicly. What helped you get to that point where you were just, I mean, I read this and I was like, Morgan's like, fuck it. I'm putting it all out there. Like, I don't give a shit. My mama's gonna read it. Who cares? This is me.
Prayer. Oh, okay. But besides that, I mean, I basically told myself, I said, I am not gonna cut corners and sanitize my life with my debut. You can go into any single bookstore and you have, our attention span is like the width of like an ant's toenail. you don't even know me. So if you're going to go in a store, you need to be able to grab somebody's attention. Now, that's not to say that I wrote things just to be provocative, but it's like, I'm not going to cut corners with what I want to share about myself. I think, I mean, there was a lot of anxiety about what I was divulging, even about my own life, because I'm a Black woman. I know about the spaces that Black women have cultivated for themselves, whether it is a kitchen, whether it's your auntie's car after church service, somewhere, these pockets of spaces. And I was worried that I was violating these spaces by talking about myself, talking about, porn, or talking about colorism or things like that. But it's like, I wasn't always Black girl magic all the time. And I'm not going to lie to another Black girl and act like I was. I was severely traumatized.
Yeah. Well, part of the magic in being a Black girl is like, yeah, I have trauma. I'm a whole person. Like, magic is not just like sunshine and rainbows all the time.
Magic
like,
isn't, it's not a lie. It's not magic a, is right, a lie. But, it has to be true in order to be real.
But there were certain instances where I don't know if people were doing it to like shade me, but there would be times when I would go to events and people would say, well, what do you think about this idea that white editors just want you to perform your pain? And I didn't know if it was directed towards me, but I was like, no, my white editors, mind you, publishing is 89% white around that. So a lot of your Black faves have white editors or white publicists or white marketing teams. Let's just put that out there. But nobody said to me, hey, what is the most vicious things that happen? Yeah, like go with that. Like this isn't a girls episode. If any of you seen Girls, like nobody said that. Mm-hmm. The thing for me is that I felt like I finally had the space to be able to share what I wanted to share. And I had to tell people, like, if you read the first chapter of my book, I talk about the cheerleading incident. Yeah. I tried out for an all-white cheerleading team. I didn't make it. When I told a friend of mine who was a girl of color, wasn't Black, we got in an argument and she said, well, you know why you didn't make it? Because monkeys like you don't make the team. That was when I knew I was Black at 10 years old, was by being compared to an animal. And the reason why I started with that essay was because I wanted to show people that is the most heartbreaking thing for any human being on this world to go through. The moment you realize that you're different, you're compared to another species. And so for me, it's like, it's hard because when you're honest about your pain, you can leave yourself susceptible to so many different things. People, you know, you're putting energy out there. You don't know what people are going to do with it. People might want to humiliate you. People want to say, you know, people might want to be like, well, you know, this isn't my story. It's not supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I said that in the first chapter. I was like, this is my story, is not a one size fits all story. I hope that when you read it, that you go out and read other narratives. But people were still upset when it was like, oh, but I didn't relate to it. I'm like, good,
good.
Well, you know what I'm saying? Like, you're not supposed to relate to 100% of it.
We need to take a break. So we'll be back with Morgan in just a bit. And now we're back.
Even with us, like, sharing, well, there's certain things that will be out in the world that we had a freak out breakdown session, like, like, literally crying in Charlotte's car on, like, the highway in LA because we shared these crazy personal stories and we're like, fuck, dude, people are going to hear this.
People are going to judge us.
And people are going to, like, judge us intensely, but it's the thing of sharing your authentic experience of the way that you've lived, right? And it shouldn't be cookie cutter and fit in anyone else's box, but it's yours. And in sharing like who, it's like making the personal universal.
Yeah.
And sharing your story, there was so much of myself and my own experiences that I found that may have looked a little different. Your whole chapter on like dating,
man, and like, I was like, I'm never going to get a date again. And be like, man, I am never going to get a date again after writing this chapter. So,
it's so relatable. You have one story that I was just like, is Morgan in my lived experience of like going on like two dates with a dude and hitting it off and being like, this is forever. Like, we can lock it down. And you're just like, what the fuck was I thinking?
Well, you know, like sometimes I have really bad secondhand embarrassment or just like reliving embarrassment. So I could be sitting at home like watching Claws. And all of a sudden, I'll think about something that happened when I was like 22, 23. And I was like, oh, like, I'll just curl up because I'm like, why did I do that?
I love like your experiences are like 22, 23. I'm like, oh, last month. right. last week, yesterday, well, 5 minutes ago in the green room.
Well, I mean, and that was hard because, you know, when I was growing up, and I know this might be eye rolling do some, but I was always just told I was smart. So I didn't really think that I was pretty until I was like 22 years old.
Can you just hold my hand on that? Because that is like us.
But also, I'm getting all these signals I'm gonna be alone. Like, I went to an Ivy League university and I just knew, man, I knew when I got to college, I was like, I'm gonna at least date somebody. I didn't even kiss anybody those 4 years. And it was like, and my mom, by like year three, going on four, she was like, I don't know what's going on. Like, because nobody besides my sister, like no one on my mom's side of family went to college. So they thought, okay, get your degree. But now she's gonna finally meet somebody on your own level. So when it didn't happen, you could just feel like the timbre in her voice just started to change.
You're gonna meet your black doctor.
Started to become ominous. And I was like, yeah, it's really hard out here. But you're just getting all these signals like, you're too opinionated, you're too loud, you know, black women aren't getting married. Like, and when you keep getting inundated with that, when you do go on dates, you do want to lock it down because you're like, I want to prove to people that I don't have to shrink and somebody can love me, that I'm ever expanding, ever evolving. So yeah, I got into situations with men where it just was disastrous. Like one, oh, can I tell like a little
please,
bit of one?
Please,
so, oh my God.
Please.
So...
I love it's just like, Stephanie, I'm so sorry, but it's like, fuck the mics. Like, no.
I know. It's a lie. It's a lie.
Works.
So, so I wrote this article when I first moved to New York about like being a black gentrifier in Harlem, and it went viral. And this one guy got in touch with me. He's like, I live in Harlem too. Like, I would love to talk to you about the piece. I'm like, all right, fine. Went to like a cafe and started talking, but I was like, oh, like I'm actually having a good conversation with this guy, black guy, investment banker.
He's checking a lot of boxes.
Toni Morrison, like, fan. I'm talking about he could, like, he could quote Song of Solomon. Like, he was wonderful.
Had he read some Bell Hooks? Because yes, that's like, if I need to do that, read something, like, sign this, we're getting married.
Everything. Oh my God, everything. And we started dating, but I just knew. You know, you get that thing, you're like, it's not equal. And, you know, it was like a thing where I would text him, 12 hours would go by, wouldn't hear anything. But I assumed because he was an investment banker, and I had friends who were in that, he would come home, his home, and he would still be on the computer doing work. So I'm like, oh, okay, like he's busy. He was also taking care of his mother and sister who were in a different state. So I was trying to make all these excuses.
They were great excuses.
Man, I'll tell you, I'll never forget. This was the day where I actually broke. One time I went to his place and I saw like this sand in a Ziploc bag. And I was like, where's this sand from? No, listen. And I was like, where's this sand from? Like, why is it in a Ziploc bag? He told me it was sand that he got from Cape Coast Castle in Ghana. You know, the castles where they used to hold like the Africans in before they took them into it's like the point of no return, right? I think that was one of Elmira. But he kept it. So what I did, his birthday was coming up. So what I did was I bought a engraved mason jar from Etsy that had a Ghanaian proverb on it for his birthday.
They don't deserve us.
They don't. Listen, I had it prepared. I was trying to expedite it so I would get it the night before. So I say to him, happy birthday, the day of his birthday. Like, I'm so glad you're in my life. I was just really excited. Didn't hear from him personally. I get a group text message about a party at a bar. And something was like, don't go. But my mom was like, if you don't go, you're making a statement. So take a friend with you. Took a friend with me. Went out to dinner. And I'm thinking, why am I not meeting up with this guy that I'm seeing? Went there. As soon as we went to the bar, something in my body, it just was like, I'm not supposed to be here. And I'm about to erupt.
All the ancestors were like, he's trash. Like,
It was something like it was just rumbling. He comes in and like he says hello to my friend first. Who didn't even meet. He never met her. And he says hi to me. Didn't give me a hug or nothing. He goes to the bar. My friend looks in my face and she's like, are you ready to go? I said, we need to get out of here like now. And she was like, all right, one more joke. I said, you got to hurry up. We didn't even cross the as soon as we crossed the street, it was near Grand Central. That's why it's so hard for me to even go Grand Central around there at the time. As soon as we went to Grand Central, like, I cried so hard. I cried so hard that, like, she had to wrap her whole arms around me
to keep me
from collapsing. So, like, when we went on the, when we got on the train back uptown, like, I literally was, like, staring at the, like, I literally just felt like I went in, like, catatonic shock. And, you know, we stopped talking. You know, he tried to, like, you know, say whatever. I don't know. But we stopped talking. But then he got back in touch, like, 2 or 3 months. Things were going well in life. It always happens. When things are going better than life, you're just going right back around. He came to me, and he was like, you know, he wanted to talk to me. So I'm thinking, oh, okay, maybe got his stuff together, want to be together. And he basically was like, oh, like, I just want to hook up or something like that. I was like, no, I don't want to do that. Yeah. And when I stood my ground, he said, like, you sound like you're falling to the stereotype of the overachieving Black woman. When he said that, like, that was the devil. I'm sorry if you don't believe in it, but that was like, you literally hit me with the biggest, like strike that has been haunting me since I knew that I had a voice. And you use that against me at the moment that you couldn't get what you want. But yeah, you love Black women's literature so much, right?
Not.
Like,
he
you know what I'm saying?
You know
and then he later apologized because he knew, not before the book came out. He later apologized and he knew it was
before
wrong.
The book came out.
But like, I'll never forget that because I was like, at the moment where I stood my ground, I hate to say it, but I was like, a Black man used that against me. I'm not trying to make it seem like I'm Black man hating, but hey, guess what? I'm telling my truth. Like, and I know Black women writers before me, they got like, I mean, when Alice Walker wrote The Color Purple, Black men were pissed off about that. Knowing good and well, they know a mister in their life. You know what I'm saying?
It happened when I read that story. Yeah. I related to that story so much because I had moments like that in college and throughout my dating life where that happened.
But 6 months ago.
I was blessed enough. Yes, she did.
Yeah, I did.
I was blessed enough to read a book called He's Just Not That Into You when I was in college. If you've never read that book, basically the book is just like, if he's not calling you, he's not that into you. If he's not texting you, he's not that into you.
Well, we make these really great excuses.
But I'm telling you, like, after I read that book, I was just like, okay. If a dude did that to me, if he didn't call me, if he didn't text me back, if he didn't show any interest, I just let that go. And it was the best thing for me.
It's a therapy.
It's a therapy thing. Sarah's so strong and confident that she's like, he didn't text me. I'm not calling him back. The wrong man will ruin your life. And I'm like, but what if he's changed?
So the thing is, like, I feel like I've grown up watching the women around me, like, be with men that ruined their lives, frankly. Yeah. that they didn't deserve, that they chased after those guys didn't show interest. And I was just like, I don't know if I have the energy for that. I don't have the mind space for that.
Well, no, you don't have the energy.
I don't.
But I think it's just like, so I look at your story where you're like, you got him this beautiful jar on Etsy. I hope that you send a Venmo request for emotional labor to get that money back. But it's like that thing of you like, so if you send some, you give someone something beautiful and then you're like, shit like that happens, you're just like, he's so broken inside that he can't appreciate this, like,
he's not into you, bro.
And it's just like,
like, he wasn't into me, but I was like, you know what? I just hope that, like, if he still has that mason jar, that, you know, maybe he haunts him like the ancestors, like he's like, ooh, in the middle of the night.
But I
don't know. Like, I think my thing is like, someone had to tell me, is like, don't lose that softness.
Yeah.
No matter what somebody does to you, like, no matter what the world does, you have to maintain that softness. And I used to hate it because I was like, man, it's just so much easier to be like, fuck man it. Of shit, people
men
of
trash.
Shit.
Yeah.
Can I write my books and then go to Acapulco
but don't,
or something?
Can I ask, like, Morgan, are you in a relationship right now?
Are you dating?
All right, you are. So you are.
No comment. But what I will say
is that's a confirmation.
What I will say is ever since I went to therapy and ever since I've been okay with, like, I want this, I don't want that. I think I need to just set my standards. I've been able to invite better company into my life.
Well, you
so like our dad's order.
Yeah. People on a different wavelength once you, like, I don't know. It's like, once you find confidence in yourself and you're like, I'm awesome. Yeah, I'm a lot.
But I love what you said about softness, because I feel like because I was very much in therapy, like, throughout the whole time. But I felt like that was something I had to combat even after you got love. Even after you have someone who says, I love you,
it was really hard to be soft and to trust and to be chill and like mm-hmm. believe. Like there was this, I don't know if the word is cognitive dissonance or like just like it was hard to believe the reality that somebody would love me, which I think is like a really hard thing to face. It was a really hard thing to face.
But it's honest.
That's the one thing that I have to, I still have to work on is like stop, what is it called? Like making everything catastrophic when something hasn't happened yet. Yeah. Like I think for me, it's like I never expect good things. That's probably why I worked as hard as I did in my career, because I'm just like thinking of all the hypotheticals that are bad. And you know, my therapist was like, the therapist ahead of time, she was like, well, why don't you ever imagine anything good? Why don't you think that God or the universe or whatever you believe in is working for your good on your behalf? And I've heard that, you know, in like church services, I grew up Pentecostal, but it was like, I never could accept it. So like, I think when someone like, well, if a significant other says I love you, or like a friend says I love you, I'm like, my first reaction is why?
Why?
I didn't work, like, you know, but seriously, because I'm always like, I didn't work for it.
Yeah.
Like me, it's like, I want to endeavor and make an effort. I don't like just being.
Yeah.
Like, so that's always hard.
I have the opposite thing where I keep waiting for like the other shoe to drop.
Oh, yeah, no, that's the same thing. It's like something about to happen. Like
something's about to happen. Or if someone's like, I love you, and you're like, I'll trust it for a second, but then you're like, why? Is this a prank?
I know this is gonna sound really, really morbid, but like leading up to my book, like I really thought something bad was going to happen to me or like my family.
Oh my
I was
God,
like,
something is going to. Lin-Manuel Miranda said the same thing. About
I said like something catastrophic is going to happen to me or like somebody in my family because things are going just too well. Something is about to happen.
And then when nothing happened, did you become chiller?
Did you chill out? How did you combat that?
Oh,
or is it still a process? It's okay to still be in process.
It's still a process. Like even now, like I'm so thankful for the way that my career has taken hold and the opportunities that I'm given. But there's always a moment where I feel like my doppelganger is going to come from out of nowhere and like she's a fraud and then like disappear in the night or like I don't like for real. Like I'm still getting used to like you deserve good things when so many bad things are happening all the time. And it just almost feels like selfish. Like I was reading an essay like yesterday where a woman, she was talking about dating and breaking off her engagement. And she was saying how it feels so humiliating to have desires because I don't want to feel burdensome or less than self-sufficient.
Oh my God.
And
that's exactly
how I feel. Like, I don't like telling people, like if you came and was like, Morgan, what do you want? Like, what do you want? What do you want to do today? And I'm like, I don't know.
I love that, you know, I like look at you, I read this book and I'm like, you're so successful, but it's always good to see that we're constantly in process and like, no matter what your version, your thought of someone else's life, like you're still in process and you're still navigating very similar things that like we're all in this journey and you're doing it and you do deserve great things and like everyone deserves great things. Like your blessings are yours. Your ancestors are paving a way for you to receive them. So receive them and then be a gift for someone else.
Right. And that's why thank you. Sometimes I'll beat up on myself privately and I'll be like, I could have saved myself so much pain if I just would have knew what I wanted and stuck to it. But I also have to realize everybody has their own mistakes and everybody has their own road and you're not going to get it right all the time. And I can't beat myself up at this age for what I know at this age.
Exactly.
But it's always hard.
You have to go through that to get to where you are now. So with that, Morgan, this is what we ask our guest at the end of each episode. Mm-hmm. What's your secret?
My secret?
Your secret to just existing and being your full authentic self.
Oh, man. My secret to being my full authentic self is internal dialogue.
Oh, that's good.
Sometimes I'll be on public transportation. I'll be like, how you doing today? How did that project go? You okay? Like, you know, checking in. Or sometimes, like, I will, when I'm in bed, I live alone. So before, like, I just started a new job. And I used to live alone. So it's hard because you're a woman living alone. Again, you're like, if something happens to me in the shower, like, who's going to come and get, like, it's just like certain things. But some days I'll before I go to bed, you know, after I pray or like whatever, I'll just be like, you know, you are loved. You are full of love and you're going to be okay, kiddo. Yes. And then I'll just like go to sleep.
That's a good affirmation. You are loved. You're full of love and you are going to be okay, kiddo. Normally I have like a piece of paper where I write everything that
sometimes
I say.
Sometimes it's good to write. Yeah. Good to write things down, you know, affirmations. So that's what I do. I just like to check in and like actually talk to myself because I work as a senior editor at Zora, which is a new digital magazine for women of color. And I'm used to dealing with other people's words all day. So it's very easy to drown out what I'm thinking when I'm dealing with everybody else's processes. So it's always good to check in with myself.
So Stephanie, we want to shout out Stephanie, our amazing Black woman producer, who is a dream and a goddess. I think if people had questions, they sent them to Stephanie. Did anyone have a question?
Did I miss anyone's question?
Okay. What was the hardest part of writing a book and starting a podcast? So it's for both of us. Okay.
I think the hardest part about writing a book is even the editorial stage, like they can tell you have more in you that you're not saying. So it's very like psychoanalytical. So when I was writing the first essay, I was cutting a lot of corners and my editors, being that they were so astute, were like, no, you got more to say there. And I did. So that was always hard because I'm like, no, like I don't want to say anymore. That's all you're getting. Yeah. So yeah.
I would say that's similar to the same. The hardest thing about starting a podcast is, you know, we had a really like a come to Jesus conversation together, which was like, how much are we going to share?
Yeah.
On
we're
this
both and very
like,
private. We've just grown up very private. Like,
depends on how many drinks
very,
I have in me, but I'm normally like very private.
And it required us to talk about things that I would only talk with a friend, a close friend, or in a private conversation. And we're like, potentially, literally anybody could be listening to this.
And
I'm talking about like some sexual desire that I've never spoken out loud. Podcast,
or just an experience that I've never shared with anyone that's like deep and personal. And some, you know, when you're in the process with your good friend, you just start sharing.
You do,
and then it's only after you like, oh, I don't know if I want that in the world, but it needs to be in the world because someone else maybe is going to benefit
from
hearing the story. So
I think even before we even did the podcast, like the process of pinpointing what are we talking about? Like, we know that there are so many books, there are so many podcasts, and if we are gonna come out with one, if we're gonna command your attention or demand your attention, that we should be saying something that isn't out there or isn't out there in the way that we're doing it. Mm-hmm. So we really took a lot of time, Lauren and I, to like really think about what do we want to say? What is this podcast about? Like, what are we doing? What are we calling it? Like, who are we having? Like, we thought about every guest. We thought about every episode.
It had so many iterations.
It had so many iterations. It changed. The title changed.
It started
changed.
Like, being called like, what would Oprah do?
Yeah.
Like,
at one point, we called it Happy List.
Happy List. We were depressed at that time.
But I think the experience of that made me feel like, let things grow, let them start somewhere and grow, and let it evolve, and put work into it, put time into it.
It's
we literally put time into even before we even pitched it. Like, I had written on a Stitcher show. Like, it was like a narrative show for Stitcher, full disclosure. And so I was like, oh, when I'm done writing on this show, I'm gonna pitch a show because you know, I'm poor and that's how I think. And so like, I need work. So I'm just like, all right. And then we just like put work into it. So that's the actual process of how we did it.
Yeah.
Next question. Listening to the first podcast, loved all the strong advice for standing up in the workplace. Thank you for listening. But how do you make the culture, how do you move the culture forward without alienating bros or liberals with blind spots at work? This is a really layered question.
Layered.
And to me, it feels like that question that I got when I was doing the stand-up set after Trump won, when a white comic asked me, do you hate white people? Because it was just like, no, I know I think it's a racist question.
I think it's the same. What would his reaction be?
Because I was just like, what are you gonna say now? You know what I mean? Like, what did you want from me? like with that question. And I think it's a blind spot that white supremacy gives people, where literally you don't have as much to lose. You don't have as much fear as I have in this circumstance. And your first question is centered on you and how I feel about you and how you feel bad in your guilt. And I'm just like, I'm literally scared for my life.
White supremacy to be like, even if you're calling them out, you still need to make them feel comfortable. And it's like, you shouldn't feel comfortable. I don't feel comfortable in any moment of my existence. Like,
I think the answer to this question is I don't care about to make people feel comfortable as much as I used to. And I think it's part of, I love the title of the book, This Is My Undoing. I think it's part of the undoing. I think it's something that started like when I started that podcast and I started with a white co-host and I was just like, I can't talk to you about some of the things that I want to talk about because I feel like I'm apologizing half the time. And I don't want to.
Yeah, don't be afraid to have difficult conversations that are necessary and to like hold your ground and know your truth and don't let anyone tell you that your truth is not like valid or real and need an explanation for it. I feel like that happens a lot in conversations with white people, particularly in the workplace, of like they want to understand and it's like, but you can't.
Yeah.
And like,
it's also
that's
not
like
your job to make them feel better or to like, if they feel alienated, why don't they take the step to ask you what's up? Or like, if they feel alienated, they can do their own self-discovery and ask, why do I feel alienated? Like, you're not doing anything. You're just existing.
You're like, just existing. And it's like forcing people to do the work. But it's like, it's really.
Can you tell
this
I'm
is
mad?
The fucked up. This is
I'm
fucked
like
up.
Really bad. Like, I'm so mad. Yeah, no. Like a hymnal.
It's
like,
the fucked up of it. Just because you still need a job. You know,
I had to go speak at a really like ritzy bank in the financial district and they wanted me to talk about my life. And I was like, all right, I'll tell you about my life. And then like this really bro-y looking young guy, you could tell, like he's making a shit. All right, am I allowed to curse?
Yeah,
do whatever you want, Morgan.
Making like
mad.
A shit ton of money. And you could tell, like, he's, like, all-American. So he asks a question. He's like, and granted, I'm just talking about my life. I'm talking about getting in the publishing industry and, like, all that. He says, what do you think we should do about affirmative action? And I said, well,
gonna throw
the
this
first
mic
thing
across
you
the
have
room.
To understand is that affirmative action was put in place to benefit white women. I said, if affirmative action was what you think it is.
Were you like, ask your mother what she thinks about affirmative action?
If affirmative action was what you think it is, I said, every Ivy League university would like HBCU. And I said, it's not. I said, I went to Princeton. Princeton was 7% black. That's not, and that's mainly like, I'm just going to shake the table. It was mainly West African Caribbean. It wasn't African American. Like, it was like probably 2%. And that's not, and probably 1% excluding athletes. So we make up 30% of the population. Hey. So, and so when he left and everyone left, like people were apologizing for him. And I said, let me just say this. I said, I know how to command a room and I know how to keep it balanced because I'm the one at the podium. And I said, the thing about it is he didn't even look me in my face when he asked the question. That was number one. Number two, like when you ask me that, when you ask me that, no. When you ask me that, when I'm in the same room as you and I went to a competitive university probably like you, what you're basically saying is how do we not make more like you? That's why you asked me that question. That's why you asked me about what do we do about affirmative action as if it is a problem. But since you couldn't make eye contact with me, I'm going to educate you on what affirmative action really is. And that was that.
I love the I love
don't
this question.
Don't get into these conversations unless you know the history of
I love this question so much because I feel like it's at the heart of what our podcast is trying to do. I feel like it's at the heart of what this book is trying to do, which is to undo this perspective in the first place of us feeling like we have to make someone feel comfortable. We have to make sure that they don't feel alienated when I've always felt alienated.
Exactly.
Like, why do I think it's easier said than done because as a human being, you're nice and you're kind and you want to make people feel good. But I think it's okay to just not engage as well.
Also respect your own energy. It is not your job anyone.
Yeah.
Like, don't feel the need to over-explain. Just take care of yourself in that. And if you feel like I'm overexerting, like emotional labor and energy is real.
It's real.
And it's not free.
The last question we've got is, Morgan, what do you do to decompress after a really stressful day? And we're going to end with that question.
Should I say it on the podcast?
Say it on the podcast. Say it. You masturbate.
Is it masturbating?
No, it's not. I'm so sorry. I hope I don't get in trouble. I have an edible.
Nice.
Oh, that's so...
I live in LA. That's like everybody. Grandma's having an edible.
Man, my first time taking an edible, I was on my book tour. And it
Morgan's
was in LA.
A pothead.
No, I'm not. No. But like, I went to a store and they were like, have you ever had an edible before? And I was like, no. So
Did
the guy was like,
much?
It was a gummy. And he was like, take one. And he was like, take one. And I was like, all right. So me and my agent go out to eat. I eat. And like... Literally, we're talking about men and like dating, and it literally felt like someone pulled the plug out my back. I was like, what just happened? And she was like, did it hit him? You're like, no, what just happened? And then it just got funnier from there. I was trying to cut my steak with the wrong side. A Drake cover song was playing overhead. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm so blessed. I'm so happy.
Yeah.
Yes. Where am I then?
So the answer to that question is drugs.
It's drugs.
It's not drugs.
It's not a drug.
It's definitely
I will
a drug.
Say, you know,
100%.
Nothing's wrong with the edible.
Don't say that because my mom.
No,
your mom is smart enough to know that weed is drugs.
No,
but it's also it's
not.
Like it's fine. It's a gummy bear.
Don't be in denial, guys. It's drugs.
It was
a CBD.
All right.
To incarcerate black and brown people in massive raids.
I smoke a joint and take a bath every night, and it is the key to my survival. Yes.
Oh no.
Like in the tub, it's like joint classical music.
I do a combination. I haven't been smoking as much. I haven't been drinking as much, even though I am drinking tonight. But I've started using essential oils like an old lady.
Oh, that's
so amazing.
That's so beautiful.
I've been using rose oil and neroli oil. Delicious.
Shyla's
really good.
I love it
rose
too much.
Oil.
Yeah.
But so when
yeah.
you talk to Shyla, you will notice that she smells really good.
Smells
I'm
delicious.
Currently using a natural deodorant, so don't get too close.
Don't get too close.
Shyla smells beautiful.
But besides that, if you don't want to partake edibles, like I do decompress by like watching funny videos on YouTube. I'm obsessed with Paternity Court. It's trash.
Paternity Court?
Yes!
I'll do that. I'll watch reality TV. I'll just turn off my devices.
Oh my God.
Turning off my
fiance.
Devices.
That's how I decompress. Yeah. 90 Day Fiance.
So just bullshit, guys.
Just bullshit. Fall in a 90s R&B YouTube wormhole. Just be like, what is Tevin Campbell up to now?
Yeah,
and then it's 2 a.m. and you're like, I
do
feel great.
Bullshit.
Yeah, I'm tired of this smart intellectual damn day. I want to watch some mess.
Yeah.
Like, I want to watch some.
Should we do a word of the week before we leave?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What's the word of the week, Charlotte?
I feel like the word of the week for this talk is authenticity.
Okay.
My perception is that you're living your most authentic life, and it's something that I aim and try to do on a daily basis. So authenticity.
Yeah.
It feels good. Thank you,
guys.
Thank
you guys so much for coming out.
We are your hosts, Charlotte Lauriston and Lauren Domino. The Secret Lives of Black Women is a production of Stitcher. Our producer is Stephanie Kariuki. Our editor is Gianna Palmer. Special thanks to our chief content officer, Chris Bannon, sound designer, Brendan Burns, and our recording engineers, Jared O'Connell, Jordan Duffy, and Andy Christens. Make sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter @theSLBW. See you later.